Today on the Inside Flap.
When I was younger, it wasn't necessarily a home that was encouraged to read. I grew up in a predominantly white working class environment. And books were used to prop open doors.
Oh. I catch ya.
You know, we look at that in terms of kind of losing time. Mm-hmm. So if there's a kind of switch into personalities, people can lose, you know, an hour here, sometimes lose anything up to, you know, a few days, a few weeks sometimes.
Wow.
And which is, as you can imagine, absolutely terrifying for people. They don't know where's that last week gone.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the table to my left is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy, and thanks for hopping aboard. This is an Inside Chat edition of the Inside Flap, our midweek self-quarantine edition of the Inside Flap. So,
Well, we're not quarantining. We're social distancing.
That's what we are. Social distancing. So, welcome to the show.
The Inside Flap.
We have a great guest for you today. We have Maxine Mei-Fung Chung will be joining us in just a little bit. Had a great conversation with her. Really enjoyed it. Her new book is so good. I love this book. It's called The Eighth Girl. I'll talk about it in just a little bit. About a girl with dissociative identity disorder. I really needed to step up. I mean, you'll hear that in our talk with Maxine. I needed to step up my disorder game, because I kept thinking it was a book about a girl with a split personality, but that is not correct. You do not want to say split personalities
or multiple
anymore,
right?
Or multiple personalities or any of that. It's a dissociative identity disorder.
It's okay.
Yeah, it is okay. So thank you guys for joining us.
Also, Dave, I'd say it's a good thing that you don't know that terminology changed.
I guess so. That is true. We're here. We're down in the basement. I have been off work now for a couple of days. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, getting ready to put it up for you guys on Wednesday. Sylvia and I have been going out and hitting the track a lot. So, Sylvia's getting into some running, so I've got some. My hope is that now this will be the second wave of the running boom. There was a big running boom in the 70s. Jim Fix and his book. came out, and there was a big, huge, massive boom for runners. Now, my hope...
Why do you think that was?
...is that now he had this book, Jim Fix, credited with starting it.
Oh, he did?
Yep. Name of his... And that's... His book is not on my list because...
Wasn't very good?
It's an older book. No. I'm sure it's a fine book, but I haven't read it.
So I'm only
putting books that I've read on my list.
Have you talked about this list?
The complete book of running. I'm getting ready to talk about it. But anyway, so as we're getting ready to hunker down, I called my parents to make sure they're doing well. Made a little phone call down there just the other day. I think this was on Sunday. Was it on Sunday? Yeah, Sunday when I called down there to make sure they were, you know, keeping the house locked up, not letting anyone in, all that stuff. Called down, not going out, you know, whatever I said to my mom. And she's like...
Not hosting bridge parties?
She's like, well, we were just out last night with some friends. Like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Yeah, we were over at your sister's place. They had friends over. We were all out. And I'm like, no, what are you? I understand Arizona is a little bit behind Colorado right now, but it's coming. You know, you got to prepare yourself. And I sat her down over FaceTime. I really just had to sit her down and kind of like put a little scare into her. And she's nodding and looking at me understanding what I'm saying. And she's like, all right, well, tell your father this. I'm like, great. All right, put him on the phone. She goes, well, he's out getting eggs right now. What do you mean? He's out. Yeah, he went to the store. Well, he's wearing gloves. Like, no, you guys should not be going out to the store right now. Well, I think I finally got through to them. But
Arizona had their... their governor is Republican, and I've noticed that a lot of Republican governors are not
a little slow in the uptick,
a little slower
to sound
on it.
The warning alarm. Yeah.
Don't know if that has anything to do with it.
But this was me on my phone with my mom.
Yeah.
Warning, warning, warning. Isolate yourself. Social distancing.
Yeah. And Arizona held primaries today, despite what they were told to do. They still
went through with the primaries.
Went through with the primaries. Wow. And those polling places are
chock full of seniors.
Ridden.
What are you doing?
I know. I don't know.
What is going on down there?
I don't know.
Oh, man. Number two pencils.
I think Florida did too, which is another senior filled place.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
How are your parents making out?
Well, it's funny you should ask because my parents also, my dad in particular, has gone out to the store. My dad has a weird compulsion
living
now to eat out all the time. Now, I got
to
tell you guys that
the eating out all of a sudden.
As of Tuesday, as of today, St. Patrick's Day, that we're recording this, all restaurants and bars are closed in the state of Colorado.
So he has no choice now to go out.
You can get a takeout from a restaurant that's open, but restaurants don't run on takeout money. So that is going to be a limited time if they can even afford to do that. That's not how they make their living. So, it's like, your dad wanted to go. We went and dropped off our taxes at Lene's office. And your dad wanted to go out to that lunch spot in Parker. I was like, no. Well, so then we drove by JP Nori, which is a sushi place near where we live.
Yeah.
And they were closed. I was like,
she was surprised that they were closed.
They're closed. They're closed.
He's obsessed with getting pizza. So it's
he is
pizza.
Obsessed
we're
with getting pizza.
We're going over. We're going to sit outside tomorrow.
We're going to bundle up, sit outside, and have some pizza.
Yeah, that'll be nice. Mm-hmm. But it's the day before. He keeps texting. What kind of pizza?
What kind of pizza would you like?
What kind of pizza?
Yeah.
I think we finally got it figured out.
Yeah, he's got a hankering. Oh, and I just got back from the park. And at the park, honestly, to keep people from socializing with one another, they're going to have to manacle us inside of our home.
People don't want to pay attention, do they? They don't want to follow the rules.
No, I'm not exaggerating when I say this number because I counted because I was walking around the park.
Okay.
There are 40 men playing soccer. One soccer game with 40 people in it up there. And the other kind of weird thing is I was looking at it. I don't know how you tell who was on which team because there was no...
They're not shirts versus skins.
No. It's a little chilly today. It's not that chilly.
How do you know what it passes to with
But there
to,
weren't
that
like
many
a
people.
Solid versus white. There wasn't anything. I have no idea what they were doing.
And I'm guessing each player is not keeping a 6 feet distance away from the other players.
No. So it was 20 versus 20. And then I get around to the part where the basketball courts are, and all of these players' wives and girlfriends are playing basketball together. So it's one giant game of basketball with all these women.
Is anybody watching the news?
No, all these
reading
women.
The news?
And the kind of funny thing is, I walked around it twice. So the second time I looked to see if there were any men at all playing with the women, and there were three guys. Maybe they'd had it figured out.
Was that game shirts versus skins? Was it? No?
No.
Okay.
Sure, the guys would have been happy to pop off their tops, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the other funny thing is when you pass by the men playing soccer, it's brr, 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 kind of angry shouting voices, you know?
Right.
When you pass by the women playing basketball, which... Again, they had way too many players for even a normal game of basketball.
It's so crammed in there.
It's, all that. And then there's three guys among these women with huge smiles on their faces.
Oh my, I guess so.
Having a blast.
How did they get that? That is weird.
I know. It was really actually funny to see that.
That is hilarious. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see everybody sticking to the
guidelines.
Yeah,
we're all having a good time up there.
Everybody's out there having a laugh. Having a laugh. All right. Well, like I said, hopefully this will spark a running boom. And with that in mind, I've got my top 10 books about running for you guys. So we're going to start out with a couple of nonfiction books, and then we'll move on to some fiction. So here we go. My number 10, in no particular order, we'll start out with the nonfiction. First is called a book called Running with the Kenyans, Discovering the Secrets of the Fastest People on Earth. Now, this is by a British guy. His name is Ad Haranand Finn. His last name is Finn, F-I-N-N. It's called Running with the Kenyans. And he takes, it actually takes his family. He's got his family of five, and they move to Kenya. And he's a big runner, and he actually runs with the Kenyans for a year to determine why it is that these Kenyans win all these marathons.
I am familiar with this book. The results
that he finds is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I really love this book. He also wrote another book called The Way of the Runner, in which he goes to Japan. Because in Japan, they have a big running culture over there.
Yeah.
And I learned another fascinating book that I really enjoyed, all about the Japan lifestyle and how it's less about the individual. And it's more about the team. They have these events where it's a team of runners and almost in like a relay race. And that's the big race over there. Really good book, The Way of the Runner.
Interesting.
Next book is a very, very popular book. You guys might have seen this one around. It's called Born to Run, A Hidden Tribe, Super Athletes, and the Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen. This is by Christopher McDougall. A lot of this is spent... there's a lot of talk about barefoot running in here. There's a talk about a tribe of runners down in Mexico who grow up running, who run in little more than little recycled tire treads that they strap onto their feet, and just all about the running culture
and how we were born to run.
This book sparked the barefoot running trend.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Next book is a local book, Running with the Buffaloes, Season Inside with Mark Wetmore, Adam Goucher, and the University of Colorado men's cross-country team. This is a damn good book. This author, Chris Lear, he spent a year... following the University of Colorado, and they always have year in and year out one of the best, as you could guess, living in Boulder at altitude, one of the best cross-country programs. And I'm actually getting chills just thinking about it right now, that book and the lives of these young athletes, and a traumatic event happens in this book. Really, really good book. Well written, well researched, great book about young runners. Check that out, Running with the Buffaloes. Next book, The Perfect Mile, 3 Athletes, 1 Goal, and Less Than 4 Minutes to Achieve It. This is by Neil Bascom, and this is about the race to be the first runner to get that magical 4-minute mile mark. So all about Roger Bannister and 2 other runners as they furiously try to be the first runner to hit 4-minute miles, to run a 4-minute mile. Fascinating. It reads like a thriller.
I just want to try to get an 8-minute mile. I don't even know if I could do that, to be perfectly honest.
My next book is my favorite training book. This was great. If you're looking to get into running, you can do no worse. Anything you need to know about the science of running, this is your book right here. It's called The Jack Daniels Running Formula. Sounds like a joke. It's written by Jack Daniels. I'm sorry. The name of it is called Daniels Running Formula. But Jack Daniels has nothing to do with the whiskey. He's a world-renowned, the most famous running guru in the world as far as a running coach. And this book is the Bible for all runners out there. Any serious runner has thoroughly read this book over many, many times. I know my copy is dog-eared several times.
That
over.
Copy, it sits on Dave's... yes. Honestly, this is true. Mm-hmm. On your bedside table... all year round.
Oh, yeah. Full of markings, notes, notations.
Yeah, it's weird. It's just always sitting there.
I need
there.
A new copy of it. It's always nearby. It's a great reference. Daniel's Running Formula. All right, let's move on to some fiction books. This one, you might not think about it as a great running book, but when I think about it, I always think about running The World According to Garp by John Irving. And when I'm talking about it, because Garp was a runner in this book, and one thing he loved to do is he would run around his neighborhood and he would see guys run stop signs or people, you know, drivers in his neighborhood who would run the stop sign or speed through his neighborhood, and he would speed up as he's running to catch up to them so he could yell at them in the neighborhood.
I feel like there was an episode of Modern Family where like Phil or Claire did something like this.
There was a race.
Oh, okay.
There was a race. I think you're combining two. One where she wants a stop sign, but he challenges her to a race.
Oh, that's
in
right.
One episode. Yeah.
Okay.
Next book, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner by Alan Salito. This is actually a book of short stories, and the first short story is that title, but it's just a beautiful short story. Next book, Once a Runner by John L. Parker Jr. That is based on a college runner. Really good book. And my last one, I don't know how much running goes on in this book, but I had to include this one by John Updike. This is Rabbit Run.
Ah, gotcha. First in That's the funny Rabbit that you series. Included that.
Yeah, he's actually a basketball player, but just because it's got the run right there in the title, I enjoyed that one. All right, so there's your top 10 running books for you. Get out there and run. Nobody, listen, one place you're not going to catch the coronavirus is out on the running trail, is out at your local track, as long as you're not, you know,
in a shutdown situation,
hugging other runners as you cross the finish line. But Sylvie and I have been out running nonstop since this has started. So that is one good thing that's happened. All right, we're going to get to it. We're going to get to our chat with Maxine Mayfung Chung. So let me tell you a little bit about her book, The Eighth Girl. So this is a book told from two different viewpoints. Now, the first viewpoint is a girl named Alexa. And actually, now that I think about it, Alexa's story is told in multiple viewpoints because Alexa has been diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. Now, she has what she calls a, quote, flock of personalities that live inside her, and any of whom can take over control of her body at any time.
Wow.
And, you know, she's got some personalities that are domineering. She's got some that are protective, some that are just downright nasty. Mm-hmm. And she also has an innocent little girl who lives inside of her who comes out occasionally.
Sad.
Yeah. Now, the other viewpoint is told from her therapist or her analyst or her psycho,
I don't know what the word.
You know, what a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, one of those, you know.
There's a couple differences.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences, and we should check on that. Anyway, his name is Daniel, and now this is illuminating because we get to see Alexa through his eyes, and it helps us to understand what she's going through.
Now, are each of the chapters done with, like, a personality?
No, the chapters are from Alexa's point of view. Like, it'll say Alexa at the start of the chapter, and those are in first person. But then when, like, Dolly is the name of the girl, when Dolly does something, she'll say, like, Dolly does this. And then the other, or when Runner is another character, when Runner does something, Runner says this. So it's like they're real people living inside of her. Yeah. Huh. And then sometimes they take over.
Having, almost like having a conversation with one another.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Talking to each other inside of her.
So they're aware.
So she's always aware of them in there and what they're doing and what they're up to. She's just trying to control at all times her flock.
I cannot even imagine.
I know.
I can barely control my own mind. Like, it's just one of me.
Yeah. And it was interesting when and you'll hear in a second, when we talked to Maxine, how she had to keep track of not only the other characters, but how... Alexa is managing the other character. So it's a lot to keep track of. And we should also mention that when we talked to her, this was before the coronavirus outbreak.
Well, before. So
if you wonder why we don't talk to her about that, that's why. Okay, so the story is all about how Alexa's friend gets a job at a gentleman's club, if you will, and Alexa spends a lot of time there trying to keep her friend away from some of the seedy unpleasantness, the illegal activity that's going on at this club, and there's a lot of mysteriousness as Alexa tries to figure out what the hell's going on and why her friend is getting deeper and deeper into it. This book is incredibly suspenseful. It is a true psychological thriller. This is a story, now there's a lot of violence towards women, both physical and mental. It's a real cautionary tale about how easily these girls can be led astray and down this a very thorny rabbit hole by men. And now the more time that Alexa spends at the club getting embroiled in the mysterious events going on there, the more she starts to she'll black out. Like, she'll have blackouts.
Oh.
And that's when one of the other personalities will take over control of the body. And then she has no idea what's going on until she wakes up somewhere and it has to figure out exactly what is going on.
I gotcha.
And at the same time, she's got these other personalities trying to stop whoever has taken over control of the body from doing what they're doing, if they're doing something bad. And just really, really a great story. Very fascinating. And what I really appreciated is that Alexa is not just some, you know, stock character who happens to have multiple personalities running around her. We see she's a real person, and we see her backstory and understand how this came to be, and it is a very shocking backstory, and the shocks don't end there. This is an incredibly enjoyable thriller. I loved it. The Eighth Girl. Go out there, get a hold of it. It just came out. You know, we have to support authors now.
Mm-hmm.
and give it a read. And here's
to support everybody.
Have
right
to
support
everybody needs to be supported right yeah. now. Yes, including ourselves. Here's our chat with Maxine Mayfong Chung.
Say it again. You're my only friend.
I protect you from the world. I basically protect you from yourself.
Though I can't go on, I'm not satisfied with this being the end.
This is just the beginning.
Oh man, did I love your book. What a great, gripping, riveting read. Really, really loved it.
Wow, thank you so much. Thank you. I'll never tire of hearing that.
I actually can't wait to have my other personalities go back and read this book.
That's
so
right.
You have many.
No, but...
Not that we know of.
Not that we know of, but you never know what could be, what could be circling the depths of my soul. Who knows? Who knows?
Sure.
We're not here to talk about... Are you starting... You're analyzing me already, for God's sakes. All right, I'll stop that.
It's hard. I'll have to try and stop and just talk.
So this gripping read is about a story of a woman named Alexa. She's suffering from dissociative identity disorder, and her psychiatrist and a shady nightclub with some illicit goings on. Tell me, what inspired? Yes, some shady stuff. What inspired you to write this book, The Eighth Girl?
Sure. So I guess the idea came about as a direct result of my having been a psychotherapist for the last 15 years. I was becoming increasingly interested in people who had survived traumatic life events who were showing symptoms of DID, formerly known as multiple personality disorder. But there was a kind of constant thread that I was hearing from my patients, which was there was a discomfort and an unease in the way that they were being represented in the media. So they felt that they were not being truly reflected, and often they were seen as either serial killers or psychotic, the kind of usual lunatic trope.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I felt I wanted to kind of speak for them and not about them, and kind of have an opportunity to look at them as this amazing kind of patient group that I was working with, as incredibly resilient and resourceful and creative. Mm. Obviously, you know, that comes at a cost at some level, but I wanted to kind of turn the lens in a different way, to kind of think of them as heroes and heroines. And that's how Alexa was born.
Well, that's great. And I think you've totally succeeded at that, because I have a note right here. In fact, my very next question, I was going to tell you how much that the one thing that I really did appreciate about this book is how real these Alexa is, and these personalities inside of her, and how we understand how they came to be and why she's like that, why she's like this. You know, it's not just another movie about, here you go, here's somebody, here's another crazy person with split personalities, check out these wacky characters living inside of them. This is a real person, and it's, you know, been developed from this real trauma. So I think I know you have succeeded at this. So
thank you very much. And I think, you know, that these kind of characters or these characterizations or observations of people of living with multiple personalities, you know, it goes way back to the 1950s when Three Faces of Eve was first written. And, you know, and since then we've had a lot. We've had Fight Club, we've had Sybil, we've had more recently Split, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Halle Berry, who was amazing in 2010 with Frankie and Alice. So, you know, people are interested, but I just wanted to kind of give it a clinical reference.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some kind of more psychological understanding behind people who are living with DID. So I'm really pleased that you feel that we did that. So
For sure. And you certainly had the background to speak to that. Now, Alexa seems to be constantly battling against some of her personalities for screen time, you know, as they kind of want control of the body, or as you put it, coming into the light. Is this something that's common in people with DID?
I think there's an absolute exhaustion with fighting for center stage, you know, and while, you know, in my experience that there can be times when they collaborate and they can talk. I think very early days with diagnosis, it's very difficult for them to all get on board because they all have incredibly different needs. Mm. And so one of the things that we work with very early on is actually dealing with the exhaustion. Mm. Of, you know, of the kind of switching and the conflict. It's, you know, if you can imagine a kind of playground where you're telling 15, 20 kids to do a different thing, right? And but imagine that in your head.
No, I can't.
Yeah.
So so it's exhausting, and you know, it comes at a great cost to these people.
Yeah.
So exhaustion is being one of the things that has really got to be looked at in terms of self-care. Mm. But in time there becomes a little more collaboration, hopefully, and there's a lot of discussions in the DID community around, is integration ever possible, and if so, is that beneficial? Mm. Some people like to keep it that they have their separate parts, but others want a little more integration, a little more collaboration. So
yeah, you know, I'm exhausted. I'm a high school teacher, so I just get exhausted dealing with kids in the room. I would not want them inside my body. I can't even imagine.
Well, yeah, and you know, never mind kind of all the different ideas, just their different needs and their different age groups. You know, you'd be like teaching, you know, anything from kind of 11-year-olds up to 18-year-olds all in one go.
All at the same time. Absolutely insane. Now, Alexa also has some, so she's got some personalities that are working for her and some that are, you know, working against her, as it were. Sure. What, did you find that there were some personalities that you had a little more fun writing, or did you get into these personalities at all?
Totally, yeah. Oh. I mean, I have two favorites. I mean, my ultimate favorite is Dolly.
Oh, of course, yes, the young girl.
She's the youngest personality, but I have to say I have a special place in my heart for Runner.
Yeah.
Who is the gatekeeper, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
And I love that you gave her the name The Runner. That really kind of was appropriate to her character.
She kind of runs rings around people and,
running around,
you know, leaving devastation everywhere, pretty much.
But at the same time, I think her ultimate goal is to kind of protect Alexa, you know.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, sometimes when there are younger parts, that is very much required that there are kind of older parts to take care of those younger ones. So Runner felt very, very important. There were actually a lot more personalities before we limited it down to a certain number. And what we did was we kind of integrated Runner into a couple of other personalities that I'd written about, and just meant there was a little bit more depth to her rather than her just being a raging kind of protector.
Where do people with DID, I know in the book, Alexa has, a few less than 10, let's say, but can it vary? Like, can it be like two personalities up to 20? I don't know.
I mean, I've spoken to clinicians that have worked with people that maybe have four or five different personalities, but I've also worked with clinicians that have worked with people that are living with, you know, anything up to 100.
Oh my goodness.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and usually when there are that many, they kind of group off. So there may be a group of 10 younger ones.
Wow.
So it's not necessarily that they all have 100 different personalities, but there may be groups of teenagers or groups of younger personalities. So it can be, it's quite full on when there are that many that are kind of fighting for the body's attention.
I don't know how your mind is capable of doing that, because there are days when I, you know, you just forget random stuff. Like, well, I don't even remember where I parked the car.
Right.
I don't remember walking in. I can't imagine trying to hold. It's unbelievable to me.
And I think, you know, and I myself, before I started practicing as a clinician, if someone had said to me, you know, that there are people in the world that are dealing with this diagnosis, I too would have found it difficult to believe. And of course, this is the response that a lot of people that are living with DID are faced with, that they're not believed, you know, and we have, you know, many kind of, you know, for example, there's the False Memory Syndrome Foundation that believe that don't believe that this diagnosis exists.
Oh, wow.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and there's a lot of controversial issues around this, because for a lot of the time, people that are living with DID that have been survivors of trauma, that's been their storyline, right? They've not been believed.
Yeah,
so, that's true. Yeah, so it's really important that, you know, that we sort of hear them out and spend time getting to know them and hopefully give voice to them as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it seems like what she deals with a lot here is memory loss. We were talking about this loss of memory, and one thing that I think you do really well here in this book is the you know, how time gets fragmented, and we're going back in time, and then you're using TikTok, and the clock is going, and we're flashing back, and we're all over the place, and it's really jarring, and it's almost like, well, this is what Alexa is dealing with, you know, in her mind. It's got to be so jarring. I assume this is something also that people with DID deal with.
Sure. And we, you know, we look at that in terms of kind of losing time. So if there's a kind of switch into personalities, people can lose, you know, an hour here, sometimes lose anything up to, you know, a few days, a few weeks sometimes.
Wow.
And which is, as you can imagine, absolutely terrifying for people. They don't know where's that last week gone.
Can't imagine. You know? Yeah.
You know, because if we think about the kind of continuum of dissociation, if you think of one end, it can be as simple as you double book something. So, you know, you may organize to go to the dentist or the doctors, and then you've also booked to meet a friend for lunch. So that's at one end of the continuum of dissociation. And then right at the other end, you've got DID. But, you know, we all kind of dissociate. And, you know, basically it's a breakdown or an adaptation in how one's mind handles information. But when we're faced with really difficult, you know, painful situations, we dissociate to such a degree that we, you know, can lose time. And therefore, you know, people who are living with this diagnosis will just switch into an alternate personality that can deal with the trauma.
Yeah, that also, it seems to me, a much better title for it, dissociative disorder. When did that change happen? I mean, I didn't even realize.
Yeah. I didn't realize it either.
Because you think of multiple personality disorder, it doesn't sound as real. Your mind just goes straight to movies when you think of that.
Yeah.
I do,
yeah.
Yeah, and it becomes, again, that kind of, you know, that kind of lunatic trope that, you know, there's a madness attached to it, right?
So, yeah.
It kind of changed when the DSM-5 were kind of approached by lots of people that were living with DID, that they felt, as you say, it wasn't really being taken seriously as a condition. And so it changed, you know, I would say probably within the last 5 years, there's a kind of movement now where multiple personalities is kind of fading out, and people are now acknowledging DID and finding a language for it.
That's great. Well, speaking of madness, let's talk a little bit about the psychiatrist in your book, Daniel. Now, this is a great character. You know, he's trying to treat Alexa, and at the same time, you know, maybe he's looks like he might be falling for her. Now, several times in the book, we can find Daniel observing strangers on the street or in a restaurant, and he starts to kind of diagnose them. Is this something that you do? Are you doing it right now? We talked about that at the outset of this interview. We thought maybe you were...
is it a habit?
Maybe, Dave, if you were on my couch, we would be like, dialogue. But as we're kind of doing this via Skype, it's a little more tricky.
It is trickier, yeah.
I think I kind of wanted to make Daniel a kind of more flawed human being, in that, you know, we as therapists, or anybody that works in kind of mental health, you know, whether we're psychiatrists or psychologists or psychotherapists, you know, we are all wounded healers.
Yeah.
And I think I wanted to make him a fully rounded guy who had flaws, and you know, he wasn't this perfect guy. He was this kind of vigilante therapist who probably felt quite powerless. And sitting with Alexa, he kind of, you know, goes off piste and kind of is looking into all manner of things on her behalf. But yeah, he's a handful. And
he is.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that he's not just this white knight who's coming in to save the day. You know, he's got many, many flaws, and, you know, he's dealing with them as much as Alexa,
you know,
deals with her problems.
A lot of therapists are, though, because you did mention that you would get into that field of work because you're searching for answers to either yourself or someone you were really close to, I imagine.
Yeah.
Maxine, let's get into your issues. maybe we don't have time for that. I don't know.
I feel like you're analyzing me.
what kind of couch do you put your patients on?
Well,
or do you use chairs?
I have a couch, but it's not something that I encourage because I kind of wanted to challenge the stereotyped portrait of the remote passive psychotherapist. It's not the method of practice that I can use. I'm very much about a kind of leveling out of power in the psychoanalytical space. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, lying down on a couch is very vulnerable making, particularly as Freud had his situation set up. He was out of view of the client.
Yes, I'm picturing that photo of him. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I choose a kind of sitting opposite. So there's eye contact, but you know, I'm not averse to someone lying down if they've had a bad day or if they're tired or if they've broken a leg, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, we do need to make way for the injured. I think you had Daniel said it best when he said, don't work harder than the patient, I believe was how he put it. You know, let them come to you, right?
That's right. And I think any therapist that rushes in to interpret or to fix, or, you know, we forget to listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ultimately, this is what this is about. It's about a kind of listening, hearing, and really feeling what your patients are talking about. And diving in and being too busy is that, you know, it's the death of the kind of psychoanalytical space, because it really doesn't give much time and space to be heard.
Right. But I'm sure they are very nice chairs, though. We're talking leather chairs, maybe some velvet throw pillows, something like that. I'm sure.
We've got a couple of velvet ones, yeah. They're comfortable.
Yeah.
But you don't want your patient to come in thinking, like, what kind of tube low rent place is this? You got Goodwill couches scattered about, for God's sake.
Exactly. You've got a footstool, you know.
Oh, nice. Lovely.
Yeah.
Well, listen, not only is Alexa struggling to control her own body, but your book deals, The Eighth Girl, deals with child abuse, sexual assault, suicide. This is an emotionally wrenching novel in many aspects. Did you find it hard to kind of, I imagine when you're writing about some of this stuff, you really can kind of get lost in your own head about it. Is it tough to, if I can say, disassociate yourself with this after writing it?
It's a really good question, because it took me quite a while to write. You know, it's my first novel, so and I was also working full time in practice.
Oh, wow.
And so I didn't take time out from client work to actually write the novel. So I was getting up. I had quite a strict regime in getting it completed. And, you know, I would have loved to have had some time, you know, maybe taken a sabbatical or something to have written it. But this was just the situation. And it would be very difficult for me to leave some of my clients for large amounts of time.
Yeah.
So I did manage to do it. Just took a little bit longer, that's all. But I was able to kind of get enough distance. And, you know, I've got some great supervision and great support around me and great colleagues who really talked it through with me. But yeah, it was a stretch in terms of some of the issues that we were raising, as you say, like suicide and particularly post Me Too, you know, when we're thinking about where we are as women now and women's needs and wants and what that looks like. And I wanted to kind of portray that. I didn't want to hold back too much on the absolute psychic pain that some of the women and girls that go through this are in.
Right.
You know? So yeah, it was hard. It was tough, but I paced myself and tried to take my time with it.
That's good.
So yeah.
Were you getting up early in the morning and doing this before work?
I was, Laura. So I was, you know, when you hear kind of writers sometimes talk about this amazing, their muse would visit them and then they would have an idea.
Sure.
And, you know, and they kind of, I kind of thought, God, I wish that was the case for me. I'd love that. You know, I'd love just this muse to come and sit beside me and tell me what to do. And,
yeah.
But it was never that way. I was up at, you know, 5:30 every day, getting my son ready for school. Oh. And then when he went off, I did like 3 hours straight until I began clinical practice. And then again at night and weekends.
That is grueling.
Yeah.
How long?
So I don't know what to do with myself now.
I bet.
But, you know, I'm up in the morning twiddling my thumbs.
I bet.
How long were you working on the book for?
I think in total... because actually the first draft was actually written from the point of view of a 13-year-old girl.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. But we felt that there wasn't enough kind of emotional depth to the characters. It was somewhat limited in terms of her insight psychologically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think in total, from starting to write it to it actually getting published was about 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot going on in this book. Did you... you know, we don't want to give away a lot about the book. There's some many pleasant surprises along the way, some twists and some revelations that I just absolutely loved. But was that something that came fully formed to you? Did you outline that out? Did it shift along the way?
Well, you know, I think sometimes when I speak to other authors and they talk about plotting, you know, they kind of know each beat.
Yeah.
They know they're going to move through the intro and then that kind of flabby center, and they know how they're going to get momentum and they plot it out. I really struggle to work that way. So I'm very much character driven.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of let the characters tell me where the story's going.
Yeah.
And so I kind of follow the way that they're moving and their ideas and their thoughts and their thinking. And eventually the story plays out. And I surprise myself sometimes when a twist comes, because it's kind of almost taken from their actions rather than my plotting it out.
Sure, so, let them dictate it, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah,
And it's also interesting to think about that in order to get the main character moving, you have to get the people inside of her moving to figure out where she's going to go.
Huh.
That's wild.
It's a lot to think about.
You know, if you'd seen my kind of wall when I was kind of thinking about the characters, you can imagine. I had to think about what different foods they liked, what kind of they liked to do in their spare time. And so I just let them tell the story, really, which is kind of what I do with my clients as well.
Yeah, that's
true. That's kind of interesting. It's a good parallel.
Was writing, were you always interested in writing?
I actually trained in the arts.
Martial arts?
Yeah.
It sounds like you were going to say.
I did that too, actually. But,
wow. Hey, how about that?
Didn't expect that.
No, I actually trained in fine art. And so my first career was actually, I was a creative art director at Condé Nast and Sunday Times and The Times.
Wow.
But I was also doing volunteer work for women's refuges and the Samaritans. And it was just a gradual kind of moving over towards mental health. And I'd always been interested in writing, but there was always so much work to be done, you know, in terms of working with clients. But I've always wanted to kind of write a novel that, you know, that was a kind of platform to kind of examine mental health. And I think that fiction can be very powerful, you know, because we don't always want to sit down and read a very heavy, dense book, right? We want to read some fiction. So it just kind of... illuminates a little more for us.
Yeah, this is a great way. Not only do you get an entertaining, gripping, thrilling read out of it, but you do learn a lot about this disorder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it certainly made me want
to empathy.
Go read about it after reading your book. So,
yeah.
What kind of books were you interested in reading when you were growing up?
So, it's quite an interesting story. So when I was younger, it wasn't necessarily a home that was encouraged to read. I grew up in a predominantly white working class environment, and books were used to prop open doors. Or to kind of rest saucepans on. And as a little girl, I would go and rescue these little hardback worlds. And I used to love reading, and I actually found it a real kind of safe haven. And I became very close to the librarian, whose name I remember now still, which is Mrs. Veal.
Oh,
and nice. She introduced me. She took me through my early years, through adolescence, and she worked there, for, I think, for about 20, 30 years.
Wow.
And then in my teen years, I was introduced to Maya Angelou and Alice mm-hmm. Walker and Zora Neale Hurston. So
oh, sure.
I was always interested in strong female voice, which really influenced me. Yeah.
Awesome. Do you try to, and I'm assuming you kept that librarian relationship a secret from your parents. Now, we don't want them finding out about that.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's a little like Matilda, you know, when you come yeah. and, yeah. And hire books out. But it was very much a kind of secure base for me when I was growing up. Libraries were just these most magical places, so...
That's great. And so you can write a book and then you can also kick someone's ass. What martial arts are you trained in?
I have two older brothers who are really into martial arts. And so I kind of followed suit in terms of more self-protection. So I'm not actively pursuing it, but I think I'd be able to hopefully look after myself should anything happen.
So any nefarious hoodlums come up asking for your autograph, you know.
Yeah, I could do a swift arm wrestle and, you know, get them in a headlock or something.
Turn that pen right around and use it on them.
Yeah.
One thing I was wondering when I was reading this book, is it a struggle for you to... So obviously you're writing about, I'm assuming... You're getting some, obviously you're getting some stuff from your patients that they've gone through and they've suffered through. Do you struggle? How do you balance like doctor-patient confidentiality and then still write a book about it? Obviously you are telling it for them and from them, but how do you balance that out?
I think it's really important that, you know, one of the things that I'd set out to do was that this was a work of fiction. It's not in any way taken from any of my clients. But what it does is it just kind of gives me insight into understanding the diagnosis a little more. So, you know, maybe some of the behaviors or how they may think and feel. But it was very clear to me that very early on that I wouldn't be using clinical material and it had to be totally fictionalized.
Right.
And in a way, by, you know, doing that, it gave me permission to be a little more entertaining and creative with it as well. Because I think, you know, ethically, that was really important that we keep that boundary
for sure.
of what is fiction and what is clinical work.
Yeah, and that's really the way you have to go about it. And I also like the fact, I mean, you deal with some, you know, other social issues, what's going on with this, you know, in the nightclub there and, you know, really hit upon some really important stuff. I don't know how much you want to talk about that or maybe let that come as a surprise to the reader, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're talking about kind of power differentials, aren't we? You know, in a kind of patriarchal setup, you know, sometimes just how, you know, even if we just move it from the book and just think about how patriarchy can kind of really set women against each other.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that we see a little in the club in The Eighth Girl. So that was something that I felt was very important for the kind of structure of the book and the storytelling.
Yeah,
for sure. Now, I see also I have one last question for you. And thank you again for joining us.
Yeah,
it really
you.
Is enjoyable to talk to you. I can't tell you enough how much I really enjoyed your book, The Eighth Girl. But I see that you've been rewarded for your work with ethnic minorities who have experienced, you know, isolation and mental health problems. And as a high school teacher myself of ethnic minorities, there's definitely a stigma attached for them when they go to seek treatment for mental health issues, and they're definitely less likely to do so than, you know, whites. Why do you think this is so?
I think so. I think absolutely. I think it's a really important issue that you're raising, because I think, you know, it also has a lot to do with class. And I think that there's something in there that, you know, that certainly people are slipping through the net when it comes to psychotherapy. And maybe, you know, this is the one thing that I think that psychoanalysis in the past has been kind of considered, where it would say there are only certain people that are suitable for psychotherapy. And that brings a kind of real stigma to people that are living with this diagnosis. And you know, I'm involved with an organization called the Bowlby Center, which very much embraces difference and diversity, and people that maybe would have been considered unsuitable for therapy in the first instance, we take those people in and really support them. And I think it's really important moving forward. And, you know, and I think this also relates to kind of novels too. You know, one of the reasons why I made Alexa mixed heritage, she's half Chinese, was that because there were not too many Asian female protagonists out there.
Right. No.
And that feels very important that, you know, and certainly there is a current movement, you know, especially in the US around this. And that's great to see. It's really thrilling. And I just think there needs to be more exploration into diversity, whether that's with therapy or whether it's with literature. Mm-hmm. I think it's all good. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Well, Maxine, thank you so much for spending
thank you for
some
your time.
Time
thank
with
you.
Us.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Laura. It's
thank
great
you.
To
Absolutely.
See you. Have a great day.
All
thanks.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.
The Inside Club. There you go. That was our chat with Maxine.
Boy, fascinating.
That was really, really fascinating.
I
learned a lot
person.
Talking to her.
I did too.
Yeah. That was a great book. And it's funny, this is just her first book and so good, so riveting, such a great thriller. Looking forward to more books from her for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there is your quarantined, number one quarantine edition of The Inside Chat.
Social distancing.
We're
not quarantining yet.
Okay, right. I got you.
Yeah.
We're not quarantined yet. Social distancing. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you this weekend.
Manacle us inside of our home.